Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 10th, 2013, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. My name is Dean Reuter. I'm Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Your telephone has been muted until the question and answer portion of the call, so please hold for that part of the call. We're happy to welcome today Mark Delaquil. He is a partner at Baker & Hostetler here in Washington, D.C., and although the federal government is closed for most purposes today, the U.S. Supreme Court is open and hearing oral arguments, as it did in the EPA versus EME Homer City Generation case. Mr. Delaquil, very kindly agreed to attend oral argument and then give us his feedback on the case, which he'll do momentarily. As always, please be advised that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future, and all views expressed on the call today are those of the expert. Mr. Delaquil is going to start with some opening remarks, about 10 to 15 minutes or so, and then, as I mentioned before, we'll turn to you for questions, so please be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Delaquil, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. As Dean noted, the Supreme Court heard oral argument this morning in EPA versus EME Homer City Generation. I'll call the case Homer City for ease of use. Homer City concerned a Supreme Court review of the D.C. Circuit's decision on the lawfulness of EPA's cross-state air pollution rule. The cross-state air pollution rule is a multi-state cap-and-trade program that EPA intends to address the transport of particulate matter and ozone precursors from downwind states, which are generally in the southeast and midwest United States, upwind states, which are generally in the southeast and midwest United States, to downwind states, which are generally in the northeast United States. The issue of pollution transport is one of the longstanding challenges in the Clean Air Act. Every industrial facility throughout the country releases emissions. Those emissions are generally dispersed through smokestacks, which are in many cases hundreds of feet high. Emissions from the stacks enter the atmosphere and transport where the wind takes them. Historically, the Clean Air Act had addressed this issue by requiring states to include provisions in their state implementation plans that prevent emissions from the state from causing non-attainment in another state. That program was fairly clear and established a but-for causation test. If emissions in state X are the but-for cause of non-attainment with an air quality standard in state Y, then state X has to act to reduce emissions. If not, it does not. As part of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, Congress changed that concept, believing that essentially the causation standard was too strict. And it enacted Section 110A2D of the Act, commonly known, and I'll call it, the Good Neighbor provision, which provides that each plan must, quote, contain adequate provisions prohibiting any source or other type of emissions activity within the state from emitting any air pollutant in amounts which will contribute significantly to non-attainment in or interference with maintenance by any other state with respect to any national primary or secondary ambient air quality standard. It was the introduction of language emitting any air pollutants in amounts which will contribute significantly to non-attainment in that was largely at issue in the case. After EPA enacted its fine particulate matter standards in 1996 and 2007, as well as its revised ozone standard, EPA began the process of establishing a rule to guide states in controlling the transport of air emissions. The first rule was known as the Clean Air Interstate Rule, and that rule was struck down by the D.C. Circuit in 2008 as being unlawful because it used cost to determine the amount of reductions in a manner not allowed by the Act. On remand, EPA formulated another rule called the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule. The way that rule operated was to separate states into two categories: those that are having an effect on emissions in other states and those that are not having an effect on emissions in other states. Once a state was brought into the program by virtue of a finding from EPA that sources in that state contributed to air pollution problems in another state, the way that EPA required reductions was not to say that sources in state X are having this much of an effect on air quality in another state, but instead to say that because they're having an effect on air quality in another state, that the sources must reduce emissions based on cost effectiveness levels. What this essentially meant was that a source in Indiana, for example, could have the exact same effect on air pollution in Delaware as a source in Tennessee, but that the source in Indiana would be required to reduce emissions because there were cost-effective reductions available, but the source in Tennessee would not, for example, because there were no cost-effective reductions available. That's just my example. By the way, not necessarily a specific finding in this case. After EPA issued the rule, numerous states and industry groups challenged it in the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit upheld the challenge to the rule and found that the cross-state air pollution rule was unlawful for two reasons. First, it violated the text of Section 110A2D's good nature provision for several reasons. First, because EPA was not allowed to require a state to eliminate more than its own significant contribution to downwind non-attainment. Second, because EPA was not allowed to require a state to reduce emissions more than its fair share in a downwind state. And third, because the cross-state air pollution rule may require reductions that over-control, that would bring air quality down below the ambient air quality standard, and in so doing, do more than the Act required in the good neighbor provision. Second, the D.C. Circuit held that the cross-state air pollution rule violated the text and structure of the Clean Air Act because it allowed EPA to unlawfully supplant the state's authority. Under the Clean Air Act, states are allowed the first opportunity to implement an ambient air quality standard in their state plans, including with the good neighbor provision. But because the way EPA interpreted the good neighbor provision was unknowable to states when they first submitted their plans, the D.C. Circuit found that the cross-state air pollution rule violated the Clean Air Act. EPA and several public interest groups petitioned for certiorari, which the Supreme Court granted, and heard oral argument in today. At oral argument, the focus was really on two issues. First, could EPA interpret the statutory term, air pollutants in amounts which will contribute significantly to non-attainment in or interference with maintenance by any other state, to allow EPA to require reductions based on cost rather than on the actual quantity of emissions causing problems in the downwind state. The second primary issue in the argument was whether EPA erred procedurally in not giving states an appropriate opportunity to implement the good neighbor provision. As there are in many cases in the Supreme Court, there was something of a divide between two wings of the court. Justices Kagan and Breyer asked many testing questions of state and industry counsel, saying, why does the term significantly contribute preclude EPA from using cost? That was based on several policy type provisions. For example, if your EPA is using cost, what it is effectively doing is recognizing that states where controls are more effective have done more in the past to reduce their interfering air emissions. And as a result, the contribution from a state that had not done as much to reduce interfering air emissions was more significant than the actions in the state that had previously done more to address the issue. On the other side, Justice Scalia focused heavily on the fact that the statute used the term amounts which will contribute significantly, and that amounts could not be understood to refer to costs. So that was one of the primary breakdowns in the court. On the procedural issue, the real sticking point was whether or not it was arbitrary and capricious for EPA to require states to take a stab in the dark at fulfilling their obligations under the Act's good neighbor provisions, rather than providing clear guidance for states to follow in that term. Again, the divide I described previously applied to this issue as well, and it's unclear from the argument whether there was a significant majority view of the court on either point. Putting EME Homer in a broader perspective, it's notable that the Supreme Court has decided to hear numerous Clean Air Act cases over the last several terms. Dating back to 2007, the Supreme Court has heard argument in such air cases as Duke Energy versus Environmental Defense, Massachusetts versus EPA, American Electric Power versus Connecticut, EME Homer City, and later this term, we'll hear challenges to EPA's greenhouse gas regulations under the Clean Air Act in a large consolidated case called Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. The court clearly believes that these cases present significant issues of national importance and often takes them without a circuit split, given that many arise in the D.C. Circuit, which has exclusive venue over challenges to EPA regulations. A second major theme from E.M.E. Homer that's consistent with where the court has gone in the last several terms is on the question of agencies' consideration of cost in regulation. In such cases as River Creeper versus EPA, which the Supreme Court actually took as Entergy versus EPA, the Supreme Court has, over the last several terms, consistently emphasized that agencies should be taking cost into account in regulations where Congress has not expressly prohibited the agencies from doing so. And as a result, EME Homer had almost a strange bedfellows pairing, with the industry arguing that cost should not be taken into account because of the clear text of the statute, and several of the liberal justices on the court, including Justices Kagan and Sotomayor, arguing that EPA was correct in taking cost into consideration. It's always hazardous to predict the outcome of a case based on oral argument, but I think it's safe to say that this case is a very complicated one, that the court is clearly grasping at the key issues, and that it would be improvident to predict what the outcome would be. Thanks, Dean, and I'm ready for any questions that you or the audience may have.
Hi, this is Josiah Neely from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I wondered if Justice Kennedy had said anything that gave an indication of what he was thinking about in the what his perspective was in the case.
It's a good question. Justice Kennedy did ask several questions, and it was hard to see where exactly he was coming from on some of them. One of the questions that he prominently asked was whether EPA was really, by using its cost-effectiveness threshold, giving credit to states that had required emission reductions in the past. And it may have been that he was getting at an issue that EPA was allowed to view the question of contribution to non-attainment in downwind states over a broader period of time in determining what's appropriate. That was one of his significant questions. Interestingly, one of the what I think is the really problematic issues for EPA that was not discussed much at oral argument was the argument that EPA had erred because it effectively disregarded comments saying that the cross-state air pollution rule requires emission reductions that actually would bring air quality below the level of the NAAQS, i.e. that the rule over-controls beyond the issue of preventing transport of air pollutants. And Justice Kennedy, that came up at the very end of industry counsel's argument, and Justice Kennedy seemed quite interested in that point and was taking a lot of notes. But I think it would be hard to tell from his questions for sure which way he was leaning, and none, aside from the first one I described, really seemed, in my view, to get at the heart of the issues in the case.
Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. In the meantime, while we wait to see who might ring in with another question, I was asking if you might address some of the big picture items, in particular how this case might matter for the regulatory state beyond the Clean Air Act and environmental matters.
Sure. This is an important case in the Clean Air Act context, but I think it has broader implications for the relationship between the states and the federal government in programs where the state has a key role in administering that program. It's pretty common in environmental programs, including the RCRA statute concerning the labeling of hazardous waste. And you know, one of the important issues in EME Homer City is whether EPA has to give a state that's implementing an administrative program a full and fair opportunity to do so, knowing the criteria by which the agency, the federal agency, will judge the state's actions. Here, the term at issue was contribute significantly. And EPA's position is that states had an obligation to essentially take a stab in the dark at that term and to control transport in whatever means they felt was appropriate, with EPA then reviewing and that decision and accepting or rejecting it. And the states effectively have said that there's no way that we could guess that what contribute significantly means is have a 1% contribution to a problem in a downwind state and a cost effectiveness of controls of less than $500 a ton of nitrogen oxides, that that's simply unknowable and that it's not appropriate for a federal agency who's administering a cooperative federalism program to do so in a way that forces a state to take a stab in the dark. I think that's an important issue. As I mentioned, it's one where the justices' questions at argument seem to indicate that they were divided. But it's a very important issue for states and the balance of power between states and federal agencies in cooperative federalism programs. Also, the issue of cost is an important one in the administrative state. Many folks believe, and I would venture to guess, that nearly everyone agrees that agencies should carefully consider the cost of their regulations and should only act where the cost of the regulation is clearly justified by the benefits that would be generated by that regulation. And EME Homer City has something to say about how clear Congress needs to be when it displaces that authority which agencies inherently possess as part of their authority to engage in reasoned decision making. Now, in the EME Homer case, I think the industry petitioners, who were the party that raised this issue, would rightly say that it's not a question of whether costs can be considered. It's a question of at what point in the process costs should be considered. But that's also a broad theme raised by this case.
Terrific. I wonder, Justice Scalia, in asking his question, which you mentioned, where he, I think, states, if I heard you correctly, that amounts, that is, the quantity of emissions, is not the same as considering costs. Is he, do you want to say more about that question and what might be behind that question in your view?
In my view, it goes to the question really of a textual reading of the statute. One of the points that the industry folks made at oral argument and made aptly was that if you read the statute to 20 out of 20 people on the street and you use the phrase that a plan must contain adequate provisions prohibiting any source or other types of emission activity within the state from emitting any air pollutant in amounts which will contribute significantly to non-attainment in or interference with maintenance by any other state. The person who read that phrase or heard that phrase would say, well, clearly they're talking about pollution going from one state to another and provisions that would control pollution going, the pollution from one state that's actually causing a problem in the other state. They wouldn't consider it an invitation to consider costs. They would consider it to be a clear statement to the quantity of pollution. And, you know, effectively it was an argument that reading cost into that was more about sophistry with the term contribute significantly than an understanding of that phrase in context. And one of Justice Scalia's canons that he always follows, aptly described in his book with Brian Garner, is that you can't separate one or two words from the context in which they appear in the statute. And that you have to understand that the meaning of the words, of individual words like contribute significantly, relates not only to those terms in isolation, but to other terms like amounts, which clearly refers to pollution. Would be hard to understand that term in any other way.
Right. We've got one caller with a question at this point. If you'd like to join the queue of callers, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question from our audience.
Hi, Mark. This is Michael Barton from Artist Research. A question for you. If the Supreme Court strikes down the lower court opinion here, do you see that the relationship between the federal government and the state governments on cooperative federal implementation would be moving more towards a coercive federal implementation, where they're actually more commandeering states to do the federal needs as opposed to having a cooperative effect? It seems to me that if the federal government can say, you must do this, and we're not going to give you any information on how we want it done, but we'll definitely come after you if you don't do it the way we want it to do, is a little bit coercive and certainly couldn't be described as cooperative.
I could not agree more that the balance that EME Homer has the potential, if the Supreme Court strikes down the D.C. Circuit's decision, to shift power further towards EPA and away from states. And that's clearly occurring, or clearly would occur. In my view, there's this issue in the context of the Clean Air Act, where cooperative federalism is something EPA has tended to honor more in breach than in principle. And the rule under review here is certainly one where EPA's done that. And that if the Supreme Court strikes the D.C. Circuit's decision down, that EPA will know that any time it disagrees with the state decision, it can act quickly and with very little legal process. You use the term commandeering. To me, commandeering has more to do with where the federal government requires the states, the instruments of state government, to act in accordance with federal policies, whereas I think the issue here is more really one of coercion, where states, which had previously had the ability to implement plans that follow their policy choices within the meaning of the state of certain federal guidelines, or to choose to allow the federal government to do that in the state's stead, are now coerced into either doing what the federal government does or into losing that role altogether and having important decisions made at the federal level. And that's an important issue in the context of the Clean Air Act. The reason behind the cooperative federalism in the Clean Air Act is so that states can make the hard decisions about whether they want to require pollution reductions from source X or source Y, understanding their relative importance to the local economy and other considerations such as that. By allowing EPA to essentially federalize that, you're moving authority further away from those local concerns and away from what the sources, or what, excuse me, what the states would want, taking into account the view of their citizens.
Thank you so much.
Let me make another call for questions here. If you have a question, our lines are completely open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We still have time left for other questions. Looks like we have at least one more question, so let's go to our next caller.
You might have talked about this earlier, but can I ask your read on what Justice Kennedy was caring about in terms of the issues?
Sure. Justice Kennedy asked a few questions at the argument. His primary question that, and I think the one that really may have given a hint into his views, was about whether EPA's decision to use cost as a means of determining significance was really a way for the agency to credit states that had acted in the past to reduce air pollution, because in those states, new costs under the new emission reductions under the cross-state air pollution rule would be more expensive. There is a possibility that Justice Kennedy was seeing that issue in EPA's way, but it's not clear to me that that's indicative of his views even on that issue, and certainly not on all of the issues in the case. The other point that I mentioned with regard to Justice Kennedy is that he seemed to be very interested in an argument that frankly was not discussed much at the oral argument today, which is that the cross-state rule was unlawful because it would require emission reductions that would cause air quality to go below the ambient air quality standards, i.e. emission reductions that would over-control for the purposes of the good nature of the good neighbor provision. That was an issue that came up at the very end of the industry council's presentation, and that Justice Kennedy was clearly taking notes at the bench on it, potentially for further consideration. But I don't think there was but in sum, given all the issues in this case, I don't think that Justice Kennedy's questions clearly showed his hand one way or the other.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question, I'll make another call for questions here. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. This will be our final call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we've covered the topic, Mark. Let me, since we have a couple minutes left, let me give you a chance to wrap up or express any final thoughts you might have before we adjourn the call.
Sure. I think the final thought that I'd like to leave the listeners with is that, you know, as I mentioned before, the Supreme Court has taken numerous Clean Air Act cases for review over the last 5 years or so, and that these cases are really among those that are driving the Supreme Court's development of administrative law outside the context of the D.C. Circuit, which also drives the development of administrative law. And so this case, like other air cases, bears further monitoring because it's in the context of these cases that the Supreme Court will hit such issues as the use of cost and cost-benefit analysis in rulemaking, the relationship between the state and the federal government in cooperative federalism programs, standing, for example, which was not an issue in this case or not a primary issue in this case, but was very important in other air cases, including Massachusetts versus EPA and American Electric Power versus Connecticut. And so these cases, EME Homer and others like it, may really be the canary in the coal mine for the development of administrative law in the Supreme Court.
Very good. I certainly want to thank Mark Delacroix, our guest today, an expert today, for venturing out into what is an otherwise closed Washington, D.C. today to attend oral argument. We certainly appreciate you having done that and then making the call as well. To our audience, thank you for joining the call as well, and apologies for the technical difficulties we experienced during the middle part of the call. We do have a recording of this call, which we'll clean up a bit and then post online as soon as possible. So if there are parts you missed, I'd invite you to download the podcast. I also invite you to check our website for a schedule of upcoming calls. But until our next call, this call is adjourned. Thank you very much.